Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
All right, so check it out. You know how we talk about all the weird stuff they sneak into our food, our air, or even our clothes? Yeah, it turns out most shirts are basically made of plastic. You're sweating in chemicals, man. That's why I switched to Hypernatural. It's wild. They make their fabric from jade stone and crab shells. Yeah, you heard me right. Jade and crab shells. The jade keeps you naturally cool, like literally drops your skin temp down a few degrees. And the crab shell fibers, they fight odor and help your skin stay fresh all day long. So you can wear it longer, wash it less, and not smell like a dirty old gym towel. They use a fancy cotton, mother-of-pearl buttons, and zero junk. No polyester, no chemical dyes, and none of that synthetic garbage. It's clean, it's sustainable, and honestly, it's just cool gear. You can wear it anywhere, the gym, the range, whatever, and it looks legit. Go to hypernatural.com and use my code ZEROSIGNAL at checkout, and you'll get yourself 20% off. And get yourself the cleanest, most comfortable shirt you've ever worn. That's Hypernatural, nature engineered for comfort.
You're tuned into Zero Signal, a show about what they won't say and what you're probably already thinking. No fluff, no filters, no bullshit. Let's crack it open.
At this time, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelts.
Welcome back to Zero Signal. I'm your host, David, and I'm sitting here with my co-host, Jay. Tonight, we're pulling back the curtain on a war most people only see in the headlines or on Netflix shows. We're talking about drugs, cartels, dark web markets, and the kind of decisions that get made far above our pay grade. My guest spent nearly three decades on the inside. Brian Townsend is a retired supervisory special agent and resident agent in charge with the Drug Enforcement Administration. He started as a street cop in Joplin, Missouri, and then spent 23 years with the DEA chasing traffickers in places like Corpus Christi, Little Rock, and Springfield, where the official mission was simple: stop the drugs and dismantle the networks. At Quantico, he wasn't just teaching tactics, he helped build DEA's leadership and development training program, shaping how an agency over 10,000 people thinks about power, influence, and control. Now on the outside, Brian's still in the fight, just without the badge. He's a law enforcement training coordinator with the Mid-States Organized Crime Information Center. He runs Eagle 6 training, and he founded Only 2 Milligrams Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit focused on fentanyl and the opioid crisis that's tearing through America's communities. He also serves on the board of Drug Enforcement Association of Federal Narcotics Agents, and he's been featured on Fox, CNN, and across media whenever someone wants to understand what's really going on with illicit drugs, transnational crime organizations, cryptocurrency, and dark web marketplaces. This is the kind of guest who's seen the parts of the war on drugs that never make it into the press. The part that, if you didn't have the case files, might sound like conspiracy theories. So, Brian, that's the official bio. When the cameras are off, how do you describe who you are and what's the one thing you want to be remembered?
Just be a decent human being, someone who was genuine, authentic, cared, and try to make a world a better place. That's really who I am and how I want to be remembered.
That's an amazing thing. I think we all want to be remembered that way. And you have a stellar career. So you obviously have a lot of high level accomplishments coming from your DEA background. And obviously you're wearing the shirt today. So only 2 milligrams, which is a nonprofit that you're supporting, and all the things that you're doing
training and really making this place a better world. So let's start with Venezuela. When you hear politicians blame a big chunk of the drug problem on Venezuela, how much of that matches what you saw in real cases and how much feels like a convenient storyline?
A lot of it right now is a convenient storyline. I think it's a lot more complicated than people think. Drugs, primarily cocaine, do come from Venezuela and that area of the world, but there's a lot of players, a lot of bad actors involved. I think there's something bigger going on. Obviously, now we've restricted airspace. You know, we don't like the president. He's been indicted in the United States. He's a bad guy. We should all mutually agree that's a good thing for him to be gone. But I don't know what's playing behind the scenes there, but certainly more than what we see. The drug boats being destroyed, I'm actually happy about that. I have no problem with that at all. I don't know how much of a dent it's going to make in our drug supply, especially when they say fentanyl. Fentanyl doesn't come from there. It primarily comes from Mexico. Doesn't mean I'm not unhappy, though. I think we got to take the war to them if there is a war on drugs. But yeah, a very complicated situation over there for sure.
I've heard that a lot of at least the base ingredients are shipped to Mexico from China. How true is that from your experience?
Absolutely, 100% true. So China is the number one source country for the chemicals, followed by India, and then there are some other countries, primarily in Europe. But China is number one by far, not giving up that number one spot. They send the chemicals that we sometimes will call them precursor chemicals to make the fentanyl, primarily directly to Mexico. And the stuff is mass produced. It comes into ports on cargo ships. From there, it's transported to various locations around Mexico, especially the Sinaloa cartel controlled areas and the CJNG controlled areas in the western part of Mexico. It's manufactured in bulk and it's smuggled over the border like they do other drugs successfully for decades now. So we do see some labs in Canada and other parts of the world as well, but China to Mexico is the primary destination before it gets to the U.S.
So when it gets to Mexico, what's the typical supply chain there? Do they mix it in with other drugs, heroin? Are they just cutting it up and repackaging and shipping it out? Or is there some sort of process that they do over there on the Mexican side?
Primarily just the manufacture of the fentanyl itself. They've really controlled that, just like they have methamphetamine since the early 2000s. They have a great pipeline, unfortunately, of precursor chemicals to manufacture this stuff. And they make it in bulk and they smuggle it. And it's usually in powder or pill form when it's smuggled. And now it does get into our heroin. It does get into our cocaine, does get into our methamphetamine. I could make a pretty good case that's primarily done in the United States by the traffickers. Not that it's not done in Mexico, but we know a lot of traffickers in the United States are involved in that as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, when I was in law enforcement, when the fentanyl crisis really started breaking out, or at least when I started seeing it, you saw a lot of the heroin addicts that overdosed because fentanyl was getting mixed in with the heroin. And what is it, 1,000 times stronger or something crazy amount that it's stronger and it's causing these kids and others to overdose on it, which is a very sad situation.
Yeah, if you look at the overall overdose numbers, I like to call them drug poisonings because I think you could make an argument that most of those folks weren't looking, probably none of them were looking for fentanyl, especially in the early 2010, 2015 time range. They were looking for heroin. We saw a spike in heroin, and you can go back further than that because of the way we changed pain management in this country in the 1990s, 1996 to be specific, with Purdue's release of OxyContin. And we just started giving out opioids like they were candy. And that increased the demand for street opioids, street heroin. Manufacturers couldn't make it fast enough. They started cutting it with fentanyl. And like you said, people were dying overnight because they had no idea that fentanyl had polluted our heroin supply. And like I said, these people weren't looking for fentanyl, looking for heroin. And the difference between heroin and fentanyl is significant. And to me, it's not necessarily the potency. It's the amount. The average lethal dose of heroin is about 30 milligrams. The average lethal dose of fentanyl is about 2 milligrams. In fact, that's why we call it our nonprofit, is a reminder. And so that's a significant difference. So you think you're, especially if you've built a tolerance, you have a bunch of heroin in front of you that you're about to use, and literally only a couple granules of salt or sand of fentanyl gets into it, which is only 2 milligrams, and you're dead. And that's why I like to call them drug poisonings and say that these people had no idea they were getting fentanyl. And the number of people dying in this country just exploded, absolutely exploded overnight. At the height of it, 2 years ago, we lost 105,000 people. And dive deep into those numbers, 75% because of one drug, fentanyl. Last year, thankfully, we saw a reduction to 80, 82,000. I don't know the exact number yet. But again, if you dive deep into those numbers, same thing, about 75% because of fentanyl. And the only reason we've seen a reduction is because of drugs like naloxone or opioid reversing drugs that have made their way on the street.
Yeah, when I was getting out of law enforcement, I forget the name of the device, but it basically reversed the symptoms. They gave them to every cop that was out on the street, and you would inject somebody if you thought they overdosed on heroin.
Narcan, not naloxone.
Yeah, Narcan, that's the word I'm looking for. Yeah, Narcan.
Yeah, that's the brand.
So do you think this new war on drugs, like taking out the Venezuelan supply boats, do you think that's helping reduce drugs that are reaching this country, or is it just a show of force?
No, I think it's helping. I really think there needs to be a holistic approach to what we're doing. I hate the word war on drugs, and not that you said anything wrong. I say it all the time as well, because when we hear that, we're waiting for an end. And I don't know that we'll ever have an end. And the reason is because we have a demand, and this is simple economics. If there's a demand, there'll be a supply. Do I think it helps? Yeah, absolutely. And I think we need to do more of that and step that up, go after these large-scale traffickers and transnational criminal organizations, go after these traffickers that are killing people with fentanyl. But at the same time, we need to increase awareness and education and figure out, like I said, more of a holistic approach. We can't, I used to believe this, but we can't arrest ourselves out of this problem. We just can't. There's always going to be a demand for drugs. And until we reduce that demand, we're really just spinning the wheel
in time. Do you think the solution is what they're doing in some West Coast communities where, like, it's under control, it's under an eye, like they're providing the needles and the drugs? Is that the solution? Or what do you think the solution is? Because I think once you're addicted to something, it's really hard to almost control it. It's like a shark in water. Like, you're going towards it and you're not going to stop until you get it. But is there an easy solution?
We got to figure out a way to reduce the demand. I think we can start by reducing stigma or eliminating stigma. But I'm not a big fan of some of the things they're doing. I'm all about helping people and figuring out if there's other solutions or other avenues we can go down. The problem is, I think because of the stigma of drug use in this country, we're not really serious about a solution. Politicians will throw money at the enforcement, and then they'll get on TV and say, hey, we just gave DEA.
Want to find a way to give back this holiday season, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. It's easy. Instead of wasting time and money on gifts that nobody wants or needs, help your friends and family give back and give to something good, something meaningful. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for a friend or family member, a cause, or an organization. Help out the local animal shelter. Get that little lending library up and running. Just make your world a better place. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. 'Tis the season for giving back, and giving feels good. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
A little bit more money, or HIDA, or whoever, a little bit more money, but that's not the solution. I was proud of what I did. I think that's certainly part of the solution. Again, it has to be more holistic. We got to look at this from different angles. And we throw a little tiny bit of money thinking that's it. And we probably spend more money fixing potholes than we do helping people that are really struggling from substance use disorder, addiction. That's real. And that's something we need to solve. Go back to the demand I was talking about. You look in the United States, we make about 4.5% of the world's population, yet we consume the majority of drugs. That's a problem. We've got to figure that out. I'd rather them, not rather, but in addition to spending money on the enforcement piece, how about putting people in our schools, in our communities, talking about these dangers? How about more treatment, especially medicated assisted treatment, MAT? But back to the original question, when we're only given a little bit of pot of money and then somebody says, we're just going to go buy needles with it, I don't think that's a solution. I think it's a Band-Aid and at best. And I'm not a fan of the needles. I'm just not. I know people are probably going to write in and criticize me or you all. Now, but did it slow the AIDS and other problems? Yeah, absolutely. And that's not a bad thing. I'm actually not 100% opposed to needles. I tell you what I am opposed to is field test kits for folks that are using drugs. And the reason is because they provide a false sense of accuracy to people. We talked about how little fentanyl it takes to kill you. And I can tell you example after example of people, especially young people here's one right here. I was talking to a family member out in California who lost her niece to a counterfeit Adderall pill. Two girlfriends who are having a little slumber party, and they bought a counterfeit Adderall, thought it was real, split it into three pieces. We're talking a little tiny pill.
Yeah.
And she never woke up after taking this piece. So they would have got a tester or something like that and tested some of the pill. You have to destroy the entire pill to tell whether or not it's accurate or not. Now that pill's gone. How about the batch? Just because that one pill was negative doesn't mean the other pills in that batch are going to be negative. It's just, I don't know, when I hear about these organizations just putting all their apples in the one basket, it's just frustrating because we have a limited amount of apples. We need to be smarter and more efficient about it.
When I was in law enforcement, right, the field tests, they were enough to like be able to make an arrest, but they weren't enough to like bring into the court and to sustain the case because they aren't always 100% accurate. And if I remember correctly, maybe things have changed. It's been a long time since I've been in law enforcement now, but like for the case you're describing, there is no field test. Like I think we use like meth field tests to try to bring it to test positive, but I don't remember there actually ever being a field test for Adderall or what have you.
There are field tests for fentanyl now, and I'm actually excited for the use of those in law enforcement community, because that, like you were saying in your application, it gave you enough to charge them or at least arrest them. And then you'd wait for the lab report before anything formal came. In fact, I work with a company out of Ohio that just made a fentanyl wipe, which is pretty cool. It looks like a Purell wipe. It's like a 5x8. And once it touches any surface, pill or anything that has fentanyl, it instantly changes color. Yeah, I think that's pretty neat. And there's a lot of products on the market, the True Narcs, the Ramen devices. But my point is, I don't have a problem with law enforcement using this. I think the application sense, because we need to know. You're on the street, you need to know whether or not this substance is meth, cocaine, marijuana, whatever. But from a user aspect, I think it's a false sense of security. And I know of one story where some young people bought a pill for everyone and then one extra pill that they tested. And that pill tested negative. So they all thought, we're good to go. This one's negative. And one of the children died because his pill wasn't negative. And that's the dangers of putting all our eggs into one basket, thinking that these are going to save people. And I don't know. I have problems with that.
So they're coming out of a high-class manufacturing facility for normal pharmaceuticals.
Exactly. The last couple labs I went into, they're one. Both of them had blenders. One of them had a sifter, literally a sifter.
Wow.
Where they're just sifting this stuff together. There's no quality control.
So correct me if I'm wrong. I'm looking at your bio and it said you spent 28 years in law enforcement. 23 of those was with DEA. What made you want to leave the street grind and hop over to DEA? Was there what you saw in the streets? Was there a particular incident or was it just a passion?
It was a passion. So I grew up in Northern Virginia outside of Washington, D.C. And I'm not going to say that I grew up on the streets, but I certainly didn't grow up with a silver spoon in my mouth at all. I saw what drugs were doing early on in my life to people around me and it bothered me. And I made a decision actually when I was in high school that I wanted to work in drug enforcement, but we didn't have the internet. I had no idea what that meant. And funny thing, it was at a career fair at my high school and the DEA was there. I was just down the street from Quantico, Northern Virginia, which is unheard of. They don't typically go to colleges and stuff. And there was two guys there and they were talking about DEA and no idea what Drug Enforcement Administration was. But I was like, wow, this is what I want to do. And I got lucky and just kept that goal in mind and became a police officer. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Learned a lot about myself, learned that no one ever takes responsibility. Everyone lies. And there's a lot of evil people out there who do incredibly horrible things to other individuals. But I did that for 5 years and then was fortunate enough to get a spot with DEA.
Yeah, that's the dream. A lot of people shoot for it. And it's comparatively, I think there's only 10,000 people or something in the DEA. So it's a hard spot to get in. And most people retire out once they get locked into that gig.
Yeah, it's just not too bad.
Yeah. Well, whereabouts in Northern Virginia? I'm actually located in Northern Virginia.
Okay. I was in Prince William County in the...
Okay.
Woodbridge, aka Hoodbridge area.
Yeah, that's still called to that day.
Yep. That's cool. Yeah, that whole area down there, and it's just gotten worse and worse. But
I worked in Fairfax County as a law enforcement officer, that I finished my career in Leesburg. I started a while back at Cincinnati, so I took a little bit of easier route when I came to Northern Virginia. But know that area. I partnered with that law enforcement agent out there quite a bit as well.
That's awesome.
Getting back to Venezuela, because I know a lot of people are just super interested in this topic. But have you seen it show up in your work, like cases leading to Venezuela, prosecutions that you work? Trying to understand, like, I don't understand it, like how Venezuela really plays into it. You usually hear about Mexico, you hear about Colombia, you hear about some of the South American countries, but you generally don't hear a lot about Venezuela. So have you seen it shown up in your work?
Yeah, there are tons of DEA cases that tie back to Venezuela. Like I said, their president has been involved with trafficking for a long time and Cartel de Sons. There's so many links to drug trafficking in that region of the world, specifically cocaine. I think there's something greater going on than just the drugs right now politically. But DEA's worked a plethora of cases in that region. Me personally, no, I wasn't assigned down there. Most of our cases in the U.S., domestic, if we had an international connection, it was 99.9% of the time it was Mexico. And now, the emphasis is still the big two cartels in Mexico, the Cartel Jalisco, CJNG, and the Sinaloa cartel, so CDS.
That's helpful. Thank you for that.
I'll mention this politically, and maybe I shouldn't, but President Trump just pardoned Honduras former president Juan Orlando, and that one puzzles me. And I'm hired from DEA, so I can tell you this. I don't know that you'll find an active DEA agent that can go on record and say this, but I mean, you're talking, I don't remember the exact amount, 400 or 500 tons of cocaine that they could tie back to this. Tons. We're not talking a couple grams. Give this guy a pardon. It's just, I don't get it. I'm not political. I don't care how people vote either way. In fact, I try to be real careful with a nonprofit to toe the middle line there. But I do have an opinion, and I'll support things that this president's done, and I'll not support things this president has done. I try to look at it from a clear lens and not a biased political lens. And how do you, I'm all for destroying the boats. I have no problem with that. I really don't. And I know some people do. But then you pardon a guy who, look into this guy, he was a major drug trafficker. This wasn't like the guy at the end of the block. This guy's a big deal. And a lot of folks lost their life because of this guy.
I'm vaguely familiar with that. Do you know the reason for the pardon? Was it one given?
I haven't been able to read any news today. I haven't seen anything prior to today other than the pardon. I think there was another pardon that took precedent today, some Russian guy. I haven't even been able to look into that one as well. But I don't know.
It doesn't seem like there could be a good reason.
I just don't know. There's a couple pardons that have puzzled me. Russ Albright, the creator of the Silk Road dark web. I teach a lot of dark web stuff. That one really puzzled me. I know that the libertarians were excited about that, but this one was a shot in the face to DEA. It really was. This guy was a major turd.
So you bring up the dark web. In your experience over your career, how much of a role does the dark web play in drug trafficking?
It's played quite a bit of role. A lot of folks, not just the dark web, but social media itself, a lot of folks, it's easy to buy dope online. The days of going to seedy neighborhoods and trying to pick out the drug deal, that happens, certainly. But it's so easy to go online and to Snapchat, the Meta platform, Facebook, Instagram, and find dope. It really is. The dark web is the criminal marketplaces. I don't know if you've ever been on those marketplaces, but within 30 seconds, you're online into those marketplaces. You can have that dope delivered directly to your home, and just the volume of packages being shipped all around the world is just too overwhelming for law enforcement canines or FedEx, UPS, the delivery services to actually stop it. But yeah, it's prevalent. And it's interesting. I teach usually almost always to law enforcement when I talk dark web. And I've seen this evolution where the criminal marketplaces really took off, especially after Silk Road. That's why I was against the pardon of that idiot. Sorry.
No, it's all good.
And there were a couple exit scams on the dark web and a couple other things. And what I mean by that is, let's say the three of us got together and developed our own marketplace. And we got it up and going, and we let people buy and sell drugs and murder for hire and guns and child porn and all the other disgusting stuff online. And then all of a sudden, we just pull the plug, and all that money that's sitting there, especially all the crypto that's sitting in the escrow, we run with it. And it's usually millions of dollars, literally millions of dollars. And it's interesting, the deeper I dove into that and even started speaking to folks who were involved in this criminal side, it really eroded the trust of the dark web. And there's still a lot of folks that use it. I'm not going to be naive and think that it's get away with criminal activity. But because of that, and at the same time, because of the advancements of technology, encryption, the apps that are right on our phone, we're seeing an increase in illegal criminal activity on apps like Telegram. That's a big one. Discord. We see some stuff on Discord. Kick. Just some of the apps that use the encryption and have these little private message boards. It's incredible. And people find these message boards and they buy their illegal contraband all the time. So it's not only the dark web now, it's just literally right on our phone as well.
You're right. Now, how much influence does the cartel have or play in the dark web? Is it limited? I assume it's maybe someone maybe purchasing direct from the cartels and then they set up their own app. Is the cartel heavily in the dark web, or how does that work?
Yeah, from my experience, my perspective, it's going to be more of we're supplied by someone at a high level, and maybe, I don't know how many levels above them would be quote unquote cartel member. But like I said, let's say the three of us decide to sell dope online. We have a good hook. We have a good connect. But as long as we're getting what we need, then we can be successful selling dope online. The cartel itself, sure, I'm sure there's some members here and there. But from my experience, it's mainly just they're just the part of the supply chain.
They're just the wholesalers, pretty much. They're not involved in the retail side so much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned crypto in one of your statements. Yeah, I know, I think maybe it's the regulations changing in this country, but for the most part, it's fairly anonymous. In your career, how often did you run up against trying to have to deal with that?
Towards the end of it, quite a bit more in our investigations, we were seeing links to cryptocurrency. In fact, I remember the last year of my career, we had a pretty high level drug trafficker who was using his money to get into coin mining, where he actually had a pretty impressive rig, a small building full of computers, and it was all dope money. It was all dope proceeds that was funding this. But yeah, the last few years or more, I think that's been pretty prevalent in a lot of really big investigations. It's just another form of currency that's easy to move. It's the days of moving duffel bags worth of cash still happen, but it's a lot easier for me to just hit a button on a computer and now you have $1 million sitting on your computer that you can off to your wallet and go from there. But yeah, it's definitely a lot more prevalent. And the problem is I've really seen the learning curve for law enforcement behind the learning curve. When I've seen it myself, investigators will say, oh, cryptocurrency, and it's just way over their head and they're just intimidated by it and they don't give it the time they need. And it's thankfully, we're starting to catch up. We're starting to learn what this is and how we can be successful in investigating it. And that's one of the things I talk about, especially to patrol officers and investigators at police departments and sheriff's offices, is what do you do when you get these calls, especially the fraud calls? We can show you how you can, there's software out there like Chain Analysis, TRM Labs. There's a bunch of companies out there who look at this raw data on the Explorer sites and they figure out where the money is moving and try to identify an exchange and give law enforcement a fighting chance to seize that money and hopefully recover it for the victim. But anyway, more and more cryptocurrency for sure.
In your experience, is like Bitcoin and different cryptocurrencies, are they truly untraceable where you can't identify who actually received it?
No, not with Bitcoin. So Monero is a privacy coin. That one is virtually impossible to track. So with Bitcoin, you have the blockchain, and blockchain is really technical, but the best way, cash is anonymous. So let's just say that I sell you both a kilo of cocaine for $40,000. Unless you guys cooperate, unless there's a witness, unless there's a video, there's no record of this transaction between the cocaine and the cash. Cryptocurrency, or at least Bitcoin and cryptocurrency that uses blockchain, that's not entirely true. So we have the transaction itself is going to be on the blockchain forever. You can look at every single transaction on Bitcoin since the genesis back in 2009. So it doesn't say that Brian Townsend sold these guys a kilo of coke. It just, oh, on this date, on this time, $40,000 was transferred from this wallet to this wallet. So from the law enforcement perspective, let's say now, let's tie that into one of us is I'm a victim. I lost $10,000 in a scam via cryptocurrency, via Bitcoin. Now you know who X is. X is me because I'm the victim. You can see the transaction because that's on the blockchain. You can see that $10,000 went from, let's say, some crypto ATM to some unknown wallet. So now law enforcement's job is to figure out what wallet went to, what exchange it went to, you know, whether money is still there, whether it's been transferred again, and then exploit it and use the judicial system to hopefully, like I said, freeze and recover that money.
I assume it's probably pretty difficult to identify who the receiving crypto wallet belongs to, unless somehow you get lucky and catch somebody randomly? Or is there a way to tie that back to a particular individual?
Yeah, and that's the secret sauce right there. If you guys or anyone listening is involved in cryptocurrency and you use a wallet, a custodial wallet, Coinbase, Robinhood, Binance, crypto.com, there's a million of them out there. They're like banks. So if right now we go to, I don't know, what's a national bank, like Bank of America or Wells Fargo or something like that, you can't just go in there and say, oh, my name is Joe Blow, give me an account. They're going to want your driver's license, probably a pint of blood, and your firstborn. They're going to want some things. Guess what? The cryptocurrency exchanges have to follow the same laws, the BSA, the AML, the money laundering laws. It's called Know Your Customer, KYC. So if you right now, you go online and you go to, I don't know, let's say Coinbase, you develop an account, you have to prove who you are. You have to upload your driver's license, things like that. So now we have ways to trace that money because, like I said, that money's on the blockchain, or at least the transactions on the blockchain. So if we can trace that transaction to Coinbase, to wallet number 123, then law enforcement can contact Coinbase and say, okay, we need to know who the owner of wallet 123 is. And because they have to follow the law, they're going to have your information. Now, obviously, criminals know that. And this can get really technical, but hasn't already. But there's exchanges in North Korea or Russia. Of course, they're not going to follow or be compliant to U.S. law. So if we contact them in North Korea and say, hey, we need to know the owner of wallet 123, they're probably going to tell us to pound sand.
Are you seeing this as a major part of the drug trade, or is this still like an emerging market and like crypto still very new for them and so cash is king?
Cash is king, absolutely. Because at the end of the day, let's say I'm a drug trafficker and all my transactions are in cryptocurrency coin or whatever. I can't go to the club with Bitcoin. Yeah. I can't get hookers below with Bitcoin. I have to have to convert that to cash at some point. But at the end of the day, cash is king, especially to drug traffickers.
So we all know Mexico's government's heavily infiltrated by the cartels. Have you seen that pop up in the United States, particularly on border towns like in Texas, Arizona? I often wonder, because the reach is fairly broad, especially sharing a southern border with us. Have you had any busts or heard any stories about politicians, maybe not necessarily someone in the Senate or Congress, but maybe local politicians on the border towns being corrupted, influenced, controlled by the cartels in any form?
Yeah, we have. I gotta be careful here. we've also had law enforcement as well. Very few. It's not a major issue within law enforcement, but it does happen on the United States side. I worked down in South Texas for 7 years, and our office was in Corpus, but most of our work was in the McAllen area and or Brownsville, that area of the country. And so I'm familiar with that part of Mexico, Reynosa, Matamoros, and the Gulf cartel really controls that area. And they were fighting with the Los Zetas, and we were dealing with that quite a bit. A lot of corruption on their side of the border, 100%, no question. That's still a problem. Yeah, we saw it on this side of the border. Wasn't as bad, not even close to what it was on the, or what it is on the Mexico side. But yeah, I mean, we definitely experienced it at times, but it was more for us. It was more of certain law enforcement officials that occasional bad border patrol officer or agent. It wasn't like a daily occurrence or anything like that, but it certainly did happen. We certainly did see it, and we had to mitigate that and be careful and keep our operations safe, keep our informants safe.
A lot of the times you hear on news, or perhaps, though not very real, you watch Netflix shows and you see like FBI interacting with the DEA and they're like button heads and they're blocking each other. Is there any reality to that in real life?
Yeah, a little bit, but it's, I don't know that it's necessarily agency specific. It's person specific. I had pretty good relationships. I think coming from a local agency, I understood that world. And I think it gave me a little bit of cred when I would go into a police department or a sheriff's office. It wasn't just all the feds are here. In fact, sometimes when I teach, there's a guy that introduces me. And sometimes if it's law enforcement only, he'll say, "It's okay, guys. He was a real cop as well." There was a connection there. But yeah, it happens, but it's usually people specific. Unfortunately, those stereotypes exist. And we all joke and we call the FBI fan belt inspectors and whatever. Call us drunk every afternoon. There's a lot of ribbing going on. And I thankfully had amazing relationships with those agencies. I really did. My first assignment was in Little Rock, Arkansas. And we just got along really well with all the other federal agencies. And my second assignment, like I said, was in South Texas. And there were a couple agencies who did not like us. And there was a couple officers from one particular agency who would actively undermine any DEA investigation he could. And if he found out we had a target, he would do a knock and talk, or he would somehow try to do a traffic. He literally would undermine our investigations. And it got to a point where I actually had to have a meeting with the higher ups in this agency and say, "Look, enough of this is silly. What's our goal here? Putting bad people in jail, period. I'm not a camera hog. I don't need the credit. Let's put these bad people in jail. Let's hold them accountable for the things they do. We can't play these games." I've seen more of a problem with the lack of deconfliction than I have with people butting heads like you see in the movies. That's the biggest problem I still see to this day. And it's something I train a lot when I talk to law enforcement, is we have to deconflict our investigations from many different reasons. One, from an officer safety perspective, you guys are working a case and I'm working a case. Who's to say that there's no blue on blue at some point? Because that happened because we didn't want to disclose the information in our investigation. And now maybe I'm working one of you and you're an undercover because you guys didn't deconflict, or because I didn't deconflict. But anyway, I can go on and on this stuff. Drives me nuts.
Did you spend a lot of time undercover, or were you
undercover? Yeah. A lot of time, no, but I certainly did it. I enjoyed it. A&E did a special called Undercover Caught on Tape. And I don't know if they still air this show, but season 1, episode 6.
To write that down.
Is Undercover Caught on Tape. It's on A&E. It's season 1, episode 6. And if you watch the last 18 minutes, you'll see my ugly face talk about an operation we did. A little over 20 years ago, it was actually a neat, it was a high level methamphetamine and marijuana organization. And I was able to infiltrate the marijuana arm of the organization. And I met 2 members of the cartel. We were able to lure them to a hotel room outside of Dallas, Texas. And of course, the whole thing's on video. And if you watch the episode, you'll see it unfold.
How long were you undercover for?
Every single undercover operation ever worked. It was literally, I'd go in, meet someone, buy some dope, And then boom, I'm done. I would never live in an apartment, and I had fictitious IDs and things like that, but it wasn't like a biker gang type thing like you see in the movies, nothing like that. All of mine were literally go meet this guy, buy dope from him, have a conversation with him, get a phone number from him, introduce an informant, whatever. And then boom, I'm out. And this one wasn't even planned. It was a kind of a happenstance. It really worked out really well, but I was able to insert myself into the organization and convince them that I was a high level weed dealer and to remove my source, who they were originally dealing with, and they were looking for him because they owed him a lot of money and they wanted to kill him. And so I was like, yeah, I'm looking for him too. Let's remove him from this chain, deal with me direct, and we won't worry about him anymore. And they bought it hook, line, and sinker.
You ever get scared?
You must have looked way different back in the day, because you look way too professional today.
You know what? I didn't have any facial hair. Of course, I just got my hair cut, but I always had short hair, never had facial hair. I don't know that I ever had any facial hair at all when any of the undercover. Wow. I remember one time I was working, we went into a really bad neighborhood and we were buying methamphetamine and cocaine and stuff. And I'd wear baggy pants and a ball cap, and I would just act like a punk college kid or a young executive and who was buying quantity of dope. And it worked. As far as being scared, I don't want to sound cocky because I'm not Superman, but I really trusted my team and our operational planning. That's something we're really good at DEA, is we really think about how things can go wrong, how shit can go bad fast. And we try to mitigate that. Not to say that we don't get in shootings and bad things don't happen, but I just had an amazing team around me, surrounded myself with really professional people, and we just planned very well. So I felt very confident in these situations.
Yeah, it's important. Sometimes in the local law enforcement, especially when I started doing narcotics at the local level, sometimes it was just a radio and a gun and you'd go out. Like, we're talking many years ago, and starting to work with the FBI. I don't know if I ever actually worked with the DEA before or not, but definitely extensive with the FBI. And their planning is super extensive and they have tons of resources at their disposal. And you always felt confident when you went out with those guys because you had all the tools to play with. And it was good. Only thing I hated doing with the FBI, and I can tell you, maybe DEA is much like this, is search warrants. Because as local cops, we go in, we tear up a house. We're trying to find what we're looking for. FBI's, no, you got to put everything back to where it belonged. And I'm like, no.
One of the first search warrants, federal search warrants we did with FBI, even the entry was, please, yeah, let me come in. Yeah. And they got a warrant. And that's where else, my boss was livid, because he was like, the most dangerous thing we've ever done in our life. Because we're sitting there all tacked up, ready to hit the house. And they're literally knocking on the door. And I get it. We have to knock and announce. Time was going. And that was the last time we ever did that.
Yeah. Yeah, they spent so long. Like, I would just leave them at the scene. Like, our search warrant was executed. We were done. They're like trying to pick up. I'm like, yeah, I got better stuff to do. I'm out, guys. You enjoy.
They're pretty thorough, though. I get mad. I remember one time we actually had a meeting, my last office, and we were like, you think we're missing stuff because we're going a little too fast. We got to figure this out a little bit better. We always had room assignments and things like that. You take the northwest corner and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, the FBI, of course, they probably had 18 people just dedicated per task.
Yeah, their crime scene techs were great too. So we use them sometimes.
You're absolutely right. They are.
So tell us a little bit about your Eagle 6 trading. What's that all about?
Yeah, so I retired from DEA in 2022, and I started Eagle 6 Training, and it's a training and consulting business. And I do training and consulting, primarily leadership, and not only law enforcement, but outside of law enforcement as well. I've always had an interest in training and teaching, speaking. It's just always been a passion of mine. I was always the guy, even early on in my career, where they would say, hey, the Rotary Club needs someone to come talk about DEA for 30 minutes. I'm like, oh, can I do it? I just love doing that stuff. And I had an assignment at Quantico, DEA Quantico, for about 3.5 years. I was in charge of most in-service training and actually got to start the leadership and development training unit for DEA at the academy. And I'm real proud of that. I'm proud of the work we did. I had an amazing crew of folks that worked with me. And it just, the fire was already gone. And then once I was there, I knew this was going to be my post-DEA journey. And I left DEA when I could. I'm on the board of directors for the Agents Association. Still have a lot of friends there, but started Eagle 6 Training, and it's been great. It's training is hard, I can tell you that. It's the numbers are a lot lower than they used to be, and it's not just me. A lot of trainers are having the same problem filling rooms, where you used to have 30, 40 guys in a room from local agencies. Now you get 15, 20. But anyway, that's a whole different wax there. That's staffing problems there.
Yeah, I was going to say, why is that? Because I remember back in my law enforcement days, signing up for in-service training was like awesome. You get to pick some great programs, learn some cool stuff. Yeah. Why is it down?
Staffing. There is, over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a backlash at law enforcement. I think most people love law enforcement, but most people don't come out and say that. And when some when somebody does something stupid, it makes national news, and then you have protests and whatever else. But just there's a lack of people. I'm sure when you applied for your job, you probably had hundreds of people looking for that one position. Same with me. You know, we tested every 6 months. You could have zero spots. We still tested, and we'd always have a couple hundred folks out there. Now it's complete opposite. There's some funny videos online where you'll see, hey, that application you put in 10 years ago, we're interested in you. Can you come out? What? I've been in prison for the last 7 years. It doesn't matter. On it. And that seems like reality.
Yeah, you see it probably because the local law enforcement is really in the spotlight when it comes to national events that kind of make the headlines. Are you having those recruiting efforts along, like in the DEA as well?
Absolutely. DEA is struggling, FBI, they're all the agencies are struggling. They're still hiring, they're still running academies, but it's not. When I applied, oh my goodness, probably 500-600 applications per hire. That was the norm for federal agencies and even the local and state law enforcement, but it's not like that anymore. It's creeping up in some areas of the country, but I can tell you, I've trained in a couple dozen states now in the last couple of years, just primarily leadership. And I can tell you that because I asked this question, how are you guys on staffing? And rarely do I hear we're full staff. So you have agencies that are down, and especially some of these big agencies. You look at, anyway, some really big agencies that have 400 or 500 officers and they're down 50 or 60. That's significant. And so now a lot of states have requirements for whether it's post or depending on what state you are, you have to have so many hours a year to continue your certification or whatever you call it. A lot of these departments have gone online or they figured out other ways to fulfill those needs. And that's just really, I think that's a disservice to our officers. Because like you said, not only do you enjoy the service, you learn from it and you learn from the people sitting next to you. Think of all the networking and all the conversations you have when you're at a conference or you're at training. But yeah, the big thing is staffing. That's just really hurt training.
So do you think it's affecting the quality of officers that are on the street today? Like our agencies lowering their standards of who they're hiring? And do we have less qualified people out there today because of it?
I have seen that and it scares me. And what I think is going to happen, and I hope I'm wrong, I really do. I hope in a couple of years you guys call me and laugh in my face. I think in a couple of years we're going to see some real bad incidents as these people continue to climb up in their agencies because they're not qualified. They're promoting, they're going to recruit the same type of people that they are. A lot of agencies have really increased. They're allowing certain criminal histories to come in. I don't know. Every so often I hear a department say, we've actually increased our standards. And I think, kudos to you. Good job. But you got to find other ways to recruit people, recruit talented people.
Yeah, because your officers today in 10 years are going to be your lieutenants, your captains, potentially your chiefs of police running those organizations. That gets a little bit scary if you get the wrong people in place.
It is, right? Yeah. But to others, I do a lot of leadership training and some of it's for specifically for law enforcement. And I can't tell you how many young lieutenants and captains, and I'm not saying they're not qualified or they're incompetent, but come on now, 2 years and you're a captain.
Wow.
I've seen that a lot, and wow. It's crazy. It really is. You got to put some time on. You got to figure out how the sausage is made before you start running the company.
Yeah, like they say, experience is the best teacher. That's a little scary if you don't get the experience.
Absolutely.
So in your Eagle 6 trainings, are you outside of the leadership part, are you training best practices, introducing new technology to whoever contracts with you, or how does that work?
Yeah, I'm really focused on the leadership, and I keep my leadership instruction very simple. I really truly believe that leadership is simple. It's just something we choose not to do. And I have three concepts or principles. Leadership is intentional. Just because you're in a position of authority doesn't mean you're a leader. Just because someone gave you a rank, gave you a title, gave you a bigger office, doesn't mean you're a leader. A leader, and I don't take that from those people that are progressing in the agencies. Good for them, but that doesn't make them leaders. And in society, we have this organizational leader, city leader, team leader. We always use this word really loosely, and I don't think that's a correct or fair assessment of that word. The second concept I have is that everything you do is impactful. If you take a position of authority in your organization, your team, whatever, everything you don't do is going to have an impact. And we dive deeper into these things. And then the third thing is leadership starts with yourself. You have to look in the mirror. If you're not willing to look in the mirror and fix yourself, then how in the hell are you ever going to help anyone else or help your organization? Right. And, you know, the analogy I use there is I travel a lot. I love to fly. And when you get on the airplane, the flight attendant always gives you that safety briefing that I know most people don't listen to. He or she will say, if the cabin pressure drops, an oxygen mask will fall from the ceiling. Put your own mask on before you help anyone else. And I really think that's applicable into this leadership lesson and how I teach, is because if you don't help yourself, don't look in the mirror and figure out, hey, how can I improve? How can I bring my A game? Then again, how are you ever going to be the best you can for the folks, you know, entrusted in your care or the folks that are around you? So my leadership training is really focused around those those three core principles. It really is. And I like to do a facilitated conversations with people. Nothing against PowerPoint. I use it for other classes. But if you come to one of my leadership classes, you won't see a PowerPoint presentation. It is literally us talking. I love that. I think facilitated conversation. I think we all have something to say. We all like to talk. And when you're in a room with like-minded individuals and you have the ability to freely speak, you can really learn from each other and really increase your perspective. So I do some other things as well. I do some consulting. I mentioned that product earlier with the fentanyl wipes. That was a company I was consulting with. They know I've navigated in the law enforcement world for 30 years. And even though I'm not active, I still work with law enforcement. I work for another organization where I train law enforcement. So they want my perspective. And there's other companies as well I work with. They want to know, is this a good product? What do cops think about this, et cetera, et cetera.
And then you transferred that into your nonprofit. So you want to talk a little bit about your nonprofit?
Yeah, I wear a lot of hats, right?
Yeah. Busy guy.
I started working for an intelligence center part-time, and I'm a law enforcement training coordinator for them. And then they convinced me to work for them full-time and support law enforcement in 9 states in the Midwest. And I was asked to build drug-specific curriculum, obviously because of my history with DEA. And I built a opioids class that really focused on fentanyl. And this was in October of 2022, and it just took off. It was built specifically at the time for law enforcement. And then almost immediately, we brought it to non-law enforcement, which was primarily other first responders, firefighters, EMS, and then some teachers and the recovery community, educators, politicians in there as well. And it just took off. It really did. And I thought, wow, there's something here. And I've always felt this need to serve people. I know it sounds Boy Scoutish, but another reason I got into law enforcement is because I really feel a sense of purpose through public service. And when I retired, I didn't have that anymore. And I found that when I was doing this and I was helping people and the stories I would hear and the people I was meeting, and it's just amplified. It's gotten more and more. I can't tell you how many families I've spoken to, how many folks I know now who have struggled with substance use, lost loved ones to substance use. And it just evolved. It evolved into me starting a nonprofit organization. I called a bunch of my retired buddies at DEA and says, I want to do this. And they're like, you're crazy. And I said, need your help. And they said, sure. So my entire board is retired DEA. We just brought on earlier in the year, we brought on an executive director who's not DEA, but she's phenomenal as well. And she really helps expand our message and lead us into a good strategic direction. But that's only 2MG. Our initial goal was to raise awareness of illicit fentanyl, but we've evolved to other public safety threats as well. Fentanyl is not the only thing in our drug supply. We're seeing more and more drugs, the nitazine, xylazine. Every day you listen to the news or pick up a paper, but I don't think people do that anymore. Yeah. there's something latest and greatest, and you have to stay ahead of that.
So from a drug standpoint, like, what's the greatest danger to our country right now? We obviously hear a lot about fentanyl, but what's the other big players that we should be concerned about? I was just reading about Trank the other day and how that's pretty dangerous in of itself. I think they call it the zombie drug. But what are the greatest dangers that we are facing as a country today?
Fentanyl by far, 100%. I've 30 years in law enforcement, never seen a drug more impactful than fentanyl. It has changed drug experimentation, casual drug use, recreational drug use. Trank, which is xylazine. Now we're seeing more of the nitazines, like the ISO dope. We're seeing a lot more synthetics, a lot more man-made dope. And I always joke, but sometimes I don't think I'm joking when I say this, is that I think there's a bunch of idiots out there who have a contest on who can make the next deadliest drug. Because fentanyl, quite frankly, it's not the most dangerous drug out there. The ISO, the nitazines, I just got quoted in Rolling Stone magazine on this, which was pretty cool.
Awesome. Nice.
Yeah, I was pretty excited about that. But this is a drug that's stronger than fentanyl. Thankfully, it hasn't flooded we're seeing it quite a bit in our illicit drug market, but fentanyl is by all accounts the game changer. The drug supply is much different than it was 10, 15 years ago, and it's forever changed. One of the things I look at in the United States, we have a program that DEA runs called the National Forensic Laboratory Information System, and we need an acronym, so it's NFLIS. And what it is, the DEA works with about 98, 99% of all the drug labs in the U.S. So whether you're a city officer, state officer, or a federal officer, most of the drug labs, when you submit dope, they all participate in this program. So I like to look at a couple things. I like to look at what's being submitted by law enforcement at all levels. I like to look at how much is being submitted, and I like to look at what's in the drugs being submitted. And a couple things that really blew me away is 75 to 80% of the heroin out there, if you can find heroin, has fentanyl in it. The last statistics we have, about
1% of all the cocaine out there now has fentanyl in it. 17% of all the methamphetamine out there now has fentanyl in it. So when I say fentanyl is the most impactful drug, that's why. It came in through heroin, but then it got into the meth, it got into the coke, it got into the counterfeit pills. It has transformed our drug supply. And yeah, there's a lot of other drugs out there, like you said, like Trank and things like that. And I'm certainly aware of them and certainly concerned about them, but it's the fentanyl that's the game changer.
Is it because fentanyl is cheap? Like back in the day, it used to be actually expensive. Like why is it being cut with everything, like with cocaine and these other drugs that you mentioned?
Yeah, and along with that question is why would traffickers cut it in the first place if it's going to kill so many people? I get that a lot. There's three reasons. One is it's cheap now. You can go on the dark web and you get a kilo of this stuff if you find the right buyer, seller for $4,000 or $5,000. It's nuts how cheap this is. You're talking a couple pounds for just a couple thousand dollars. And when you talk about only 2 milligrams, a couple pounds will go a long way if you're a drug trafficker. So it's very powerful. So I have folks who I know who I've spoken to who struggle from fentanyl, and they'll tell you that it's a more intense experience. It's like they know when they've gotten fentanyl. Sometimes when they don't even ask, they just know because it has a different high to it. And finally, and that'll bring them back. So that makes it more addictive. And if you're a drug trafficker, you have one thing in mind, period, to bring back repeat customers, make money. And cheap, powerful, and addictive, those are the three big ones. And I know it doesn't make sense to sell a product that kills so many people, but they're actually getting more customers right now than they're killing people. So what we all see in the public is we see these record high numbers, people dying every day. And it's unfortunate. That's the reality of what this drug has done. But they're seeing record profit margins. And this stuff costs them, the cartels, pennies, literally pennies for them to make this stuff. And their people are coming back and coming back. And it all comes back to what we talked about earlier, the demand. Yeah, the demand. This is a simple economics problem. There's this greater demand. And even though people are dying, there's always going to be traffickers out there.
Yeah. In my experience, it seemed like it was a floodgate because for a long time in law enforcement, you really never saw fentanyl on the street, but it's just someone can flip the switch and it started showing up in everything. It was a pretty intense experience to witness that as it came on. Because as you said, people started ODing on this stuff. But yeah, it was really weird. It just seemed like it was a floodgate. It wasn't a trickle. It was definitely a storm in my career.
Yeah, that's how we all feel. And it was really about, 2015, 2016 that we just, boom, it just hit us. And it just was everywhere. And then all the information went out, and the officer exposure, which as we know now is a myth. So just all kinds of stuff happening at the same time. Very overwhelming for law enforcement and for society in general.
Now, in your opinion, now this gets a little bit conspiratorial. I know the cartels have a vested financial interest in keeping repeat customers, but do you see it as like non-linear warfare from China to supply the cartels and then bring it up to the United States?
I do. And you think about it, if you look at the demographics of who's dying at the record numbers, war-aged men, that 18 to 30 years old. These are our soldiers. These are our frontline folks that we send into battle. And they are wreaking so much havoc on this country without a troop on the ground. And I know, like you're saying, it does sometimes sound like conspiracy, but that's the reality. And I think about it quite a bit. What better way to destroy our country than with this poison that kills 100,000 people a year? It's especially at that young age. It's horrible. It really is.
Now, in your experience, like these next generation drugs that are following fentanyl, are they coming from China as well, or are they being manufactured somewhere else?
Primarily China. You look at the nitazenes. That's been in the news, like I said, the Rolling Stone thing I did. China. India certainly is trying to increase their position, and there are some other bad actors as well, but China by far is the, and that's why every time Xi talks to like Trump or Biden or whoever the U.S. president is, I'm just so skeptical of it. They come back and they're like, oh, they're going to sign this and sign this. Come on. That's whatever he signs is garbage. Let's just face it. You can trust it as far as you can throw.
Now, do you, in the next 5, 10, 15 years, do you see these next gen drugs replacing fentanyl, or do you think fentanyl is the worst of it?
I don't know that it'll replace it, but I think we're going to continue to see it. Some people feel like fentanyl is crack in the 80s and the different escalation of drugs historically, where you see more of it in the news and things like that. I don't know that fentanyl is going to go anywhere because it is so cheap for them to manufacture and it is so powerful and addictive. I think we'll continue to see other drugs. As crazy as this sounds, I think the drug traffickers realize that they do. Look at car fentanyl, for instance. Car fentanyl is way more powerful than fentanyl. And every so often you'll hear about car fentanyl out there. And I used to follow this all the time. I still have access to a lot of sensitive bulletins from different law enforcement agencies and HIDAs and things like that. And every time I would see car fentanyl has made it in this geographical area of the United States. I used to make phone calls to folks I knew, whether it was DEA or local narcs. I'm telling you, every single time within a few days, it would take care of itself. Nothing that the law enforcement did. And I'm not making fun of law enforcement. All all really good people, but the traffickers, I always say that there's this crazy algorithm. Yes, a lot of people die from fentanyl, but they're making a lot more money. Fentanyl is like when 118 people die on a Tuesday night. That's not good for business. Right. So they police it themselves. So I do think there'll be more and more of these synthetics and drugs coming on the market, but I think they have to be careful that they don't overdo it. From our perspective, people are just like, how do you overdo it with fentanyl? They're really not. From our perspective, they are because a lot of people are dying, but they're making more money. And as long as that money outpaces the death, then they don't care. And they have to balance that. I know that sounds weird, but that's the reality of what they do. And they adapt really well, and they don't have laws, they don't have morals, they don't have values. They're good at what they do, and they've been doing it for decades.
Yeah, they don't want to kill off their customer base too fast.
Not too fast.
Not too fast, just a little bit. Are there, like today, are there big players in the market? Obviously, somebody's feeding the machine. Somebody's sitting at the top of the totem pole. Who are those people today, or do you know?
CJNG, Cartel Jalisco, El Mencho, he's the top of the food chain. We find him, we're $15 million richer. He is, at one time, it would have been El Chapo and the Sinaloa cartel. Of course, El Chapo's in federal prison now. And two of his kids, in fact, one of them, I think, just pled guilty yesterday or day before. But there's a lot of infighting going on now between El Mayo, which was El Chapo's right-hand man within the Sinaloa cartel, and his people who are loyal to him believe that El Chapo's kids cooperated with the U.S. government. And there's all types of things going on behind the scenes with these organizations. But because of that, they're infighting. And the CJNG, the Cartel Jalisco, has really exploited that, as they should if they're a rival organization. Because we're talking, these two organizations, just for people who wouldn't know or who don't know that who they are, we're talking like Bloods and Crips. We're talking Coke and Pepsi. We're talking Cowboys and the Redskins. And we're talking arch rivals within the cartel world. And now, because of everything going on with the Sinaloa cartel, I think you easily make an argument that CJNG has really taken the number one spot. But both of them are still dangerous organizations. They both operate in, I don't know, last intel report I looked at, probably 40, 42, 43 countries. They just have a huge footprint. They're very good at what they do. And when it comes to fentanyl, those are the two major players. Are there other players? Are there other cartels? Yeah, absolutely. All the cartels are polydrugged. They'll, and polycriminal activity, for that matter, any way to make money, they will. But when it comes to the major players in the fentanyl trade, it's those two organizations. And like I said, CJNG, they're taking over.
What does their basic supply chain look like? Are they going to China, buying the precursors, or they're manufacturing over there, shipping it to Mexico, and then somehow smuggling it into the country? What does that supply chain look like for these big guys?
Yeah, China, number one. And again, India and some other countries as well. But China, by far, number one. The chemicals, literally on cargo ships, any way they can, right into Mexico. The ports of Mexico are controlled by so much corruption. They're controlled by the cartels. They're transported into various areas around Mexico, especially the western portion of the country, and mass produced. And I think I said this earlier, they're very good at smuggling drugs into the U.S. They've been doing it for decades. And now, as opposed to just heroin and coke and weed and everything else, now you have another drug. It's fentanyl. And so, yeah, they really control that process. That's part of what we have to do in law enforcement, is to try to plug holes along that process.
Now, you mentioned methamphetamine. I always thought meth was cooked up by some hillbilly in the trailer in the middle of the woods. How long has the cartel been supplying meth?
It's an interesting story with meth, and that really plays into how successful it was, the playbook. And let me back up a little bit. So it was the hillbillies back in the 90s, early 2000s. It was we called them one pot labs, mom and pop labs, and they took over the United States with these little labs. So we responded by outlawing certain, or making it harder to get certain chemicals like ephedrine. So to this day, if you want the good Sudafed, not the crappy stuff, but the really good stuff, you got to go to the pharmacist. You don't have to have a script, but you have to give them the driver's license. You have to sign the little thing and you get the good Sudafed. When we did that, meth lab production in the United States dropped significantly. We're talking, I was a police officer in Missouri, and Southwest Missouri, and we probably did, I don't know, 10 a week. And we went down to 10 a year, like instantly. And now you talk to local law enforcement, state law enforcement, or even DEA, you do two or three meth labs a year, if that. So that happens in the U.S. The cartels love that because these hillbillies were taking over the meth trade. So they're like, okay, this is perfect. So they pick up the telephone, they call China, India, other places, but primarily China, and say, hey, this ephedrine and all these other chemicals to make methamphetamine, can we buy these? And they're like, yeah, absolutely. And that's where it all started. So they started to get all these chemicals bulk exported into Mexico. And again, right into the ports, they transport them out. And then that's when we started hearing the super labs and the really strong methamphetamine. The cartels absolutely took it over. To give you a perspective, I was down on the border from 2009 to 2016, so not terribly long ago. And we were paying in our undercover operations or even our informant operations, we were paying about $22,000, $23,000 a pound for meth. Right now, on the border, you can get meth for about $700 a pound.
Wow.
Us gringos. Yeah. It's just the reality of it. So within the U.S., maybe you're in St. Louis or Detroit or New York or something like that, and you're going to pay a little bit more. Maybe not New York, but you're going to pay a little bit more because you had to go further north with it. But that's what they did. They saturated the country with methamphetamine. They literally took over the production. They took over the entire supply chain of it. When fentanyl became a necessity because they need something to cut heroin with, they literally, when they picked up the phone and says, hey, those chemicals I was getting for methamphetamine, I'm also going to need the chemicals to make this fentanyl stuff. And then absolutely. So the same transportation methods, the same cargo ships. Literally, it was the playbook was written, and it was natural for them to control and take over the production of fentanyl. And that's exactly what they've done.
I always wonder why the drug problem is so bad in the United States. I lived internationally. I lived in China for a few years, and you don't see a lot of it. Like, most people are abiding by the rules. You don't see a lot of drug addicts or homeless people on the streets. Like, if it's there, it's very hidden. I wonder, like, where we've gone wrong as a country and why is there so much demand in the United States?
I think there's a lot of untreated mental illness, trauma, and a lot of issues that we just put band-aids on or we stigmatize and we don't allow people to get help. And we know that not all, but a lot of people who, especially at a young age, will turn to drugs and alcohol because they're coping with some real stuff in their life. And again, not everyone who uses drugs has been molested or seen some trauma, but it happens quite a bit. They're dealing with something real. And the way to deal with it is to numb the pain, if you will, through drugs or alcohol. And I think historically, we just haven't had an honest national conversation about this and really treated mental illness and all these issues and gave it the attention and the resources that they deserve. And then I also think when you look at my own life and I look at the projection of drugs, and I remember when I was a kid, Nancy Reagan, Just Say No, and
yeah,
the commercials out there, this is your brain on drugs. You see some eggs frying on a pan. Like, we were scared into this. And then you saw this slow evolution of people saying, maybe drugs aren't so bad. Maybe if we provide needles and provide safe spaces. So we had this turn of how we dealt with this from a national perspective. And at the same time, we weren't talking about mental illness. We weren't talking about trauma. We weren't talking about these other things. We just turned the corner on how we were going to deal with the drug problem itself. And to the point where there's a lot of people now who think it needs to be legalized, not because they're, you know, libertarian and believe in self, but because they just think that this is a problem that we shouldn't even be addressing. Yeah, I'm probably rambling. I could go on forever on this. It's frustrating.
It also seems normalized too, especially with marijuana, how the streams pushing psychedelics, they make it seem cool and trendy. And why don't you hop on this? It'll make you feel better. So I even argue that our culture today is mainlined into, especially with the youth, which is unfortunate. And those marijuana, especially gateway drug to some of this other stuff.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, they have, our culture has, and that's kind of that progression I saw from the Just Say No to, okay, if you're going to use it, here's a clean needle. You mentioned marijuana. That's another drug that's changed so much over the marijuana that when we were teenagers is much different than the marijuana out of the day. And people don't realize, especially a lot of parents. I can't tell you how many, just tons of parents are like, I smoked marijuana when I was a kid. What's the harm? I can't be a hypocrite and tell my kids they can't smoke weed. Let me tell you, the weed you smoked when you were a kid, not even in the same ballpark. You're talking, if you were a parent in the 1990s, you're talking, I don't know, 3 to 5% THC levels. Weed that our kids are smoking nowadays is 30% or higher. And if they're using vapes, the concentrates are 95%+. It's incredible. So we're seeing an increase in depression, psychosis, anxiety, all the things that we were told that this was going to solve, we're seeing an increase in. And it's a hot topic. I'm sure I'm going to get an email. My son's got glaucoma and this is the only thing that can make him feel better, right? And it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. This is a change drug. It really is. It's not the same. When I was in high school, you'd have to smoke 15, 20 joints to what the equivalent of marijuana today. I would welcome anyone to just look at the THC levels. And isn't there a brand now called Not Your Dad's Weed?
It's in drinks, it's in vapes, it's everywhere.
It's everywhere. And you can't find the mids, the Reggies. You can't. Good luck.
Yeah.
Really hard. And that's why some people will tell you, especially older folks who, let's say you smoked weed when you're in high school and now you're older, they'll just take one puff or even a half a puff. You know what I mean? They'll do the whole Bill Clinton thing.
I didn't inhale.
Yeah. They can't handle it because it's just too strong. It's much different.
Yeah. I'm in a state that just recently legalized marijuana for recreational use. I'm in Maryland now, and it seems like a lot of bad news. Do you have thoughts on that? You think it should be legal and controlled by the government and sold? Or how do you kind of see that path forward?
No, I actually did a video on this. I think it's a bad. I live in Missouri, and we legalized it my last year at DEA, and I was opposed to it, not from the law enforcement perspective, but because of what we were just talking about, the THC levels. We're seeing more and more problems. You look at, every time all the high is around the United States. Every time they release the reports on the marijuana impact, I like to read them and I'm blown away by them. I would just welcome, look at the early states like Colorado, poison control calls, traffic accidents involving marijuana up. Our visits up. Number one treatment patient, especially for young people, marijuana related use. It's not meth, not cocaine. Not that those things don't happen, but every single bad metric can be tied back to legalization when you compare those states to the states that have not yet legalized it. That was my problem from a public safety perspective. But again, it got political and unfortunately people will pick a hill and die on it because of that. I'm not for it. I don't think regulate. Look at the states that have regulated it. Do you realize that the cartels operate in all those states? They love it. They absolutely love it. The Chinese transnational criminal organizations, they control, absolutely dominate the legal marijuana market. Dominate it. They exploit the laws. They use strawmen as they'll use us to be the owner on paper. They're destroying the environment on the illegal grows because they won't get permits for them. Or if they do, they'll exploit it. They'll say, we're going to grow this. And then they'll end up growing 8 times as big. Especially over the last 4 years, they brought a lot of illegal Chinese nationals into the United States to work these labs. They literally handcuff them to the walls and make them slaves. They turn them into indentured servants to work these labs. It's incredible what's happened behind the scenes. All we say is it's a safe drug, legalize it, tax it. We spend more money right now in all those states. In Maryland, I don't know when you guys legalize it, but you're going to see the same thing. Mark my words, you're going to spend more money on the related social and healthcare costs than you do any tax revenue that this generates. We're already seeing that in Missouri. It's only been legalized for what, 2 years now, 3 years now. It's Colorado seen the same thing, but I'd love to see a reverse and states go back, but it's too late. The cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of it, but mainly because it's not just even stuff you smoke that you can stash away. Kids can't figure out how to really smoke it, but they're gummy bears and cookies and like anything you could think of that has the high levels of THC, which are very toxic if little ones get into it and they just think it's a gummy bear and they want to eat candy.
Real quick on that, you know what pisses me off about that too is look at the packaging. Next time you're at one of those stores, whatever, walk in and look at the packaging. It infuriates me because they're mirroring Cheetos bags or Twizzler or Star. They literally look like the real thing. If you're an adult and you want to use this stuff, I always tell people this and they always laugh when I say it, but use it. I don't care. You're an adult, whatever, but put it in a brown paper bag or something like that. Don't put it in a bag that says Cheetos instead of Cheeto.
Wow. Yeah, you're right.
It's absurd. And that goes to the people that are marketing this stuff. And they'll be like, it's legal. Yeah, it is legal to market like that. But I think it's unethical. And I don't know how you sleep at night when you do that.
So one of my last questions right for you is, what about the legal loophole? So you're seeing a lot of the, I think it's called Delta 9, that they're able to sell legally. But you're seeing a lot of this. I just started seeing like mushrooms and stuff where they're like selling micro dose of the mushrooms where people can buy and they call it for therapeutic effects. Are you seeing the same kind of issues that you're seeing with the legalization field like you would see in Maryland or what have you?
Yeah, the whole issue is, and I don't know where we stand on this right now, because let me back up a little bit, like Delta 8 and stuff, the farm bill, it made it really difficult for legalization or for non-legalization. And then fast forward to this last, the government shutdown, the temporary stimulus bill or whatever they passed, they slipped in a measure to close that little loophole on the Delta 8. So I don't know where we stand on that. I have no idea. It's so confusing right now. So I guess the real answer is to be continued on that. We're seeing more people that are trying to exploit these laws and they're playing whack-a-mole or they're changing the chemical structure a little bit of the drugs so they're not illegal, you know what I mean? And then it's whack-a-mole. And then the governments come in and say, okay, no, this is now illegal. And then they change the structure again or they find a new strand or whatever. But really confusing right now. There's a lot going on, a lot of problems with it.
Yes. So my last question, if you were the man up top, the president, how would you attack this problem?
I'd throw a lot more. Money is not the solution for everything. We see that with
with look at education. We just threw billions of dollars and we still have piss poor education in a lot of states. But I do think, going back to my original thoughts on the war on drugs, if you will, there needs to be a holistic approach, and we need to look at the treatment part. We need to wean people off the drugs. Like with heroin, it was with the methadone clinics, but now we're seeing the Suboxone and the other drugs. But it has to be in contest with, or in connection with, treatment, like the cognitive behavior. Why is this person using drugs? We can wean you off all day long from a physical, to make your brain not want the drug. But if you're dealing with some real crap in your life, we got to deal with that as well. We got to make sure that, okay, now you're clean, quote unquote, but you still are dealing with some demons that we need to help you with as well. So I think that's one of the things that I would do, is I would certainly increase our resources and our ability to do that and help people do that, and not just people who can afford it. Getting in front of people and making people aware, it's what I do with only 2MG, especially with young people. I think that's critical, and I think we need to do more of that. I think I can tell you from my own perspective, most parents won't have these conversations, unfortunately, or they won't come to these presentations because they don't want people to think that their family has a problem. That's the biggest reason I've had for parents not coming, because if we're caught there, someone's going to think that something's going on in our house, which is absurd. But anyway, I would certainly increase the resources, the tools and resources for that as well. And the enforcement part, I think we're certainly doing what we can, going after money, going after these supply chains, these distribution networks. We need to ramp that up as well, especially at the highest level. We have the cartels. They're really on the offensive right now, more so than they've been maybe ever. We need to keep our foot on that neck and just take it off. And I suspect that those cartels will fragment into other organizations. There's always going to be a need. You kill one snake, six more pop up. But we need to continue to disrupt and dismantle these organizations and make it difficult for them to operate. And at the same time, get the people help that they need to prevent that demand for the drugs.
Brian, where can people find you and reach out to Eagle 6 or Only 2 Milligrams if they want training or resources?
Yeah, Only 2MG is ONLY2, just the number 2, and then MG.com. And I do 3 presentations right now. Right now, it's only myself. I've had one other instructor who's done some local stuff, which is awesome. Eventually, we want to scale this and I have a ton of retired law enforcement folks who want to work and want to get into schools and want to get into communities and spread this message. Problem is, we just can't afford it. This is a very difficult space to fundraise in. Really is. People just don't care. We'll digress here a little bit, but a little side note. I said, what if someone dies on the street who's struggling with drugs, has an addiction? And what if that person had a pet, let's say a dog? What if we took ownership of that dog and rehomed it? We would probably raise millions of dollars. Yeah, yeah. If there's no dog involved, people don't care. They just don't. There's a stigma to it. So anyway, back to Only 2MG. Because of that, I'm primarily the only instructor. I do 3 presentations. I do what I call my flagship. It's a 4-hour presentation. I know it sounds like a long time, but I really dive deep into fentanyl, everything about fentanyl. Done it 125, 130 times. I don't know, 30, 40 states right now. I have some of the organizations I work with, some of the businesses I work with who are interested in the drugs, but they're more interested in the leadership. I developed a 1-hour lunch and learn for them because they're like, look, Brian, I don't have 4 hours to give you, these C-suite executives and stuff like that. I'm like, can you give me 1 hour? Yeah. And the cool thing about that is I actually had some of these folks come to the 4-hour because they're so overwhelmed by the information. And then I have one that I'm proud of them all, but this is one I really enjoy doing. It's a 1-hour presentation I call Shattering Dreams, and I do it for young people. I've done a lot of high schools and a lot of colleges, and I hope to do more and more of those, especially in 2026. And that's when I reach the young people. It's 1 hour is perfect if they'll give me 1 hour. Sometimes schools are like, no, you got 20 minutes, buddy. Wow. And I'll take 20 minutes if I can get, I'll take 2 minutes if I can. Heck get yeah. 2 minutes. But 1 hour is my sweet spot for that. Contact information's on there. We don't charge. If the organization can afford it, then great. Make a donation because that'll help us. One of the things that I wanted to do early on, I'm proud of, is I didn't want money to be a barrier. I don't do this for money. I'm probably the only person in this space. In fact, I think I'm the only person with a nonprofit who hasn't lost a direct family member to fentanyl. I do this because, as I said earlier, it gives me a sense of purpose. It helps me and it helps other people. And I truly believe that you got to be a person of action. If you really want to make the world better, you got to go out there and you got to get off your sofa and just and do it. You got to put your mouth where your mind is or your words are. That makes sense?
Yes, sir. It's a great mission.
Yeah, so I don't have a money tree. I wish I did, but I do self-fund a lot of what I do, or I use Eagle Six training. I pretty much wipe all my Eagle Six training profits out so I can travel. Because if someone calls me and says, we really want you to come out and do a presentation, I'm not going to say, I'm so much money. If you can't afford it, then no, that's not the conversation. I do not want money to be a barrier. I've said that from day one, and I still hold strong to that. I will find a way. If an organization, a school, whoever wants me to come out, I will find a way to fund it, whether I pay for it myself or whether I find a client. Anyway, that's what I do. From Eagle Six Training, the same thing, Eagle Six, just the number, training.com. If you're interested in training or in leadership or more consulting, happy to work with you as well.
Awesome. But we really appreciate, Brian, spending a good time with you today. It's been a fantastic conversation. And I think we learned a lot, right? Between myself and my brother and our audience, I think we learned a lot of information today. But we really appreciate you joining us here on our show.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to rewatching it.
Heck yeah, brother. Keep up the good work, man. This is some good stuff. This is amazing.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, man, that was a good interview. He's got a lot of information. I thought it was pretty interesting hearing everything he had to say.
Yeah, I know. I was super excited to talk to Brian. It fits with my background. Coming from law enforcement, obviously not super fancy in the DEA like he was, but I thought he really provided some good insight on what that drug trafficking scene looks like today and the threats that are facing our country. And I think it's important information, as he was kind of talking about, right? It's important information for our youth to hear about the kind of the value impact that he brings with his speeches and why it's important to stay away from these drugs and why, you know, even though if they legalize marijuana or they continue to legalize other drugs in this country, it still doesn't mean it's safe to do. And there's a whole lot of bad things. Like some people are like, well, they legalize marijuana, so it's okay if I go purchase a little bit and smoke weed. As you hear from Brian saying, you're supporting the cartels and you're doing a lot of bad stuff, even if you're doing that. I don't know. I think it's a reaffirming message and it's important to hear.
Yeah, I found it really interesting that China is so heavily financially involved in the legalized drug market in the U.S. I didn't know that. And I think that's scary. Man, this one country providing and shipping the fentanyl to Mexico, the components to make meth, and now they're involved in essentially the legalized drug use through marijuana in this country. It's just, man, it seems like all fingers point back to one place.
Yeah, I've heard about the precursors coming from China for a long time, but they, I think, single-handedly uplift and support some of these really bad drugs that are coming into our country, like fentanyl and meth, and being able to purchase those products. And there's really a no holds bar. China will sell you anything for the bottom line. But I really enjoyed that question you asked, because it's essentially a proxy war that we're seeing. A country is not going to step in and regulate against their enemies when they're selling precursors to drugs that are being manufactured and distributed in the United States that are killing 100,000 plus people every year. Like, why would they step in? But it's essentially a proxy that we're facing. And I think it needs more attention. I'm not sure how much it gets, because at the end of the day, money is the bottom line. How many pockets are lying that's voting yay or nay against some of these initiatives?
Yeah, I always wonder. We always talk about the almighty dollar. And how many politicians are being paid off to pass legislation, not to intervene, just to kind of let stuff to keep flowing through. The United States of America, man, like we're super high tech. We have all kinds of surveillance. We know where all the ships are coming and going. Nothing's a mystery. And it's almost, this is the conspiratorial side of me coming out, but it's almost like it's being allowed to happen. Guys like Brian fight the drug war. And as we know, the federal government determines how many agents and what their budgets are. And sometimes I think these guys are fighting with one hand tied behind their back.
Oh, 100%. It's nonstop. The ground level people are really doing the right things. Like when you talk about people like Brian, who were DEA agents, and they're out there to do the good work, make a difference. You can see how his career really transformed. Like, he retired, but he's still out in the public eye trying to pass on the good message. At the end of the day, a lot of these federal law enforcement, the heads of them are essentially elected officials. So they are carrying a political message down. You see a lot of that with Kash Patel. He was just an attorney that runs the FBI now. Not saying he's a bad or a good guy or indifferent about him, but they come in with administrations. And when Trump leaves office, whoever the next president may be will bring in their own person to run these organizations, and they ultimately dictate the policy of what's going to happen. I think it's all connected between these super PACs that we see and this global economy at scale, whether it be for goodness or badness that happens.
Yeah, I sometimes just don't understand. You brought up Venezuela. They say it's because of the drug war. I don't buy it. Again, I'm limited in my knowledge of cartels and where they operate, how big they are. But it seems like the major issues in Mexico, it seems like it's just an easy excuse, is an easy ploy to invade an oil-rich country?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get to, because obviously Brian's the expert and neither am I, but it's hard to understand why we're bombing ships. I get it. It's helping some. It's probably a good thing. Like, it's stopping drugs from coming into this country, but there's got to be an ulterior motive, because when Brian was talking about the big players, it's all in Mexico. And historically, back in the day when I was in law enforcement, you hear a lot more about South and Central American countries. Venezuela was rarely in the conversation. So is it a player in the game? Yes. Is it a huge player in the game? I'm still not so convinced that it is. And I wonder what comes down to that. Is there an ulterior motive to paint Venezuela as this big bad guy in this scenario, when even if you take out Venezuela and you remove the president from office, which they should, he's a horrible human being, and you put what they call the rightful president in, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize, and she takes over, is it going to be super impactful to the drugs that are making way into this country? My guess is probably not. I'm not the right person to be answering that question, but I really don't think it's going to make much of a difference. It's just a route and it's just a destination, but ultimately they're just going to bring it in from somewhere else. Like, they're going to, and obviously they're manufacturing the bulk of it into Mexico. So I don't know how much of a difference it actually would make, even if we achieve the ultimate end game there.
Yeah, man, I just think it's another battlefront in this global war. Like, you have Ukraine, Russia. I know Venezuela is part of the BRICS, along with Russia, China, Brazil. And it's resource heavy. I think a lot of wars we fight are banker wars and corporate world wars. So we're fighting for our currency. We want to get our access on oil that's relatively local compared to somewhere like the Mideast. That opens the door for big corporations to go down there and set up drilling rigs and refineries. And again, I think just a lot of what Iraq was about, I think it has to do with resources. I think the drug scapegoat is a easy sell to act like you're really doing something about the drug war, when in reality it's just the ploy in order to say, look over here, when in reality you're looking at something completely different.
But fantastic episode. I think everybody, if you're looking for somebody to speak on the fentanyl crisis here in the country and the problems facing our country connected to illicit drugs, reach out to Brian, reach out to his nonprofit, 2MG. Obviously doing a lot of good work. Give them donations, man. This is good work. And I thought it was almost a little bit funny when he says people don't want to show up to these seminars because they're afraid if somebody spots us in the audience that they're going to think somebody in my family has an issue. And I laugh about that. It's like, if you go to church, are you possessed? No, you're just trying to learn about the topic. Like, you're trying to gain more information. So don't let that stop you from showing up to one of his presentations. Obviously a very smart man, very well versed in this topic, and he can help you. As fathers, as strong fathers that we are, it's important to have all of the information that you can to arm yourself, because you don't know what hurdles your children are going to face in the future. And the more details you have to combat this very scary problem that's facing our country, the better off yourself is going to be and the better off your children are going to be, because you've taken the opportunity to learn this information and from a true, like, gold source about it. So yeah, take them up on it, man. Email them, send some donations his way. They're doing really good work.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, donate. He's doing it out of the kindness of his heart, off his own dime. And for me personally, man, maybe they don't, I don't know, but I feel like every school, every college should have some sort of fentanyl awareness, man. Like he said, you can get Adderall pills, die. Any sort of illicit drug that's in a powder or a pill form can be contaminated, man. It's not worth your life. It's definitely not worth your life.
Yeah, especially these college students out there experimenting. They're going through their drug experimentation phase. Like, it's not worth it for, I'd feel silly for 10 minutes. And
2 milligrams. I've seen plenty of videos where cops are going in someone's house and next thing you know, they're on the ground convulsing because somehow they inhaled some fentanyl. It doesn't take much to take your life.
Yeah, it's also just disgusting stuff and highly addictive. And sometimes all it takes is one exposure before you're an addict and you're chasing your next high. And it's not because it's good. It's just because it's addictive. Yeah, man. Scary world. What do you want to close with tonight?
Jesus love you. We love you. Brother, I love you. Brian, you're awesome. Keep up the good work. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, man. Yeah, keep up the good work. Keep up the grind. I think you're making marketable change. We'll do everything in our power to tell our listeners to come out your way and listen to some of your conferences and get involved with your organization. But as always, Jay, I love you. Been a fantastic spending the past couple of hours with you as we deep dive a really interesting topic that, you know, is connected to real life struggles that many people face. And awesome being able to talk to you guys in the audience. Reach out if you want to be a guest on our show. If you're an expert like Brian, or if somebody you can just add value to the conversation, please reach out at zerosignaltruth@gmail.com and hit us up and let's have a good conversation. Until next time, we are Zero Signal.
We're out.
We've hit the 0 hour. That's a wrap on this week's transmission. New episodes drop weekly, so stay tuned and don't miss the next signal. Follow, subscribe, and spread the word. You've been listening to Zero Signal. We're out.